have a reserve account, which is good business, any business.
I think the very fact that the bill suggests to them that they should have it, managers.
Would be enough?
Yeah.
Well, then I don't have it.
One, very, very technical thing, and duplicating the numbers on that, you might wanna say 155 or something, basically. On the amendment number six, you've got two, section 160.
Yeah, that would just go with the, I think you're.
Yeah, you could just say 155 or something like that. I said mortgage loss reserve.
That should actually appear, let's see. That could appear just, let's see, income. Yeah, I think 155 is probably.
Okay, are there further questions with respect to any of these eight proposed amendments? Are there comments by either by members of the committee or other persons who are involved in the legislation? Okay, Greening, you are.
I move for adoption.
Pardon?
I move for adoption.
Okay. All right, unless there's objection, we'll entertain Mr. Swanson's motion to adopt all eight amendments. If there's objection to that procedure, we'll take them one at a time. Is there objection to proceeding with the amendments all at one time? If not, we'll do that. Mr. Swanson moved and asked unanimous consent for the adoption of the eight amendments proposed by Mr. Greening. Did you, Mr. Greening, mean to change the wording of number six to shall?
I think it was the sense of the committee that was satisfactory the way it was.
Okay, so it'll stay the way it is, and I get the number there would be changed to 155, number six. All right. With those changes being understood within the context of the motion, is there objection to the motion? If there's no objection, the motion carries, the amendments are adopted. Mr. Greening, how do you want to proceed here, Speaker? You want to wait until the Speaker gets here?
There's one amendment that Whitewell brought up, and it doesn't appear on your sheet here. It's on page 12, and I'd like to suggest that for adoption. You look at page 12, line 17. After the word corporation investments, I'd like to add including an appraisal of market value, comma. Just to make clear that in this annual report, we wanted an appraisal made of the value of the assets. I think that an independent auditor usually would do that, but I want to make sure that each year we get a statement what the quality of this portfolio is, even though it may be earning lots of income and everything. As far as the assets, I think we want to have an annual current appraisal. So if there's no objection, I'd like to move that amendment.
All right.
It goes on page 12, line 17 after that.
What's the wording again?
After the word investments, it says a statement of corporation investments, including an appraisal of market value.
All right. All right, Mr. Greening's motion is to adopt that amendment on page 12, line 17. Is there objection to the proposed amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Guy.
Did you see the comma after investments?
Right.
There's two places there now where it says corporation investments. First one or second one? First one?
I'm talking about lines.
Yeah.
Line, the first one on line 7.
Okay.
Yeah. Are there further questions on the amendment? Is there objection to the amendment? not, the amendment will be adopted. The motion carries. Are there further proposed amendments? Mr. Rudd?
You mean by individuals or?
I
have some questions. I don't know whether there'd be amendments from it, but as we go through this bill, I have some questions on it.
Mr. Rudd?
Okay, on page six. On line two, the 30%, is any significant reason why you put 30% in there? Not 40 or not 50, or less than 25?
We wanted to put an absolute limit on it. I know if the pension funds are invested, maybe, what percentage are the?
We're 18%.
18%. We felt that, there ought to be a top limit on this. Frankly, I think the state of the market is such that no prudent investor would get into it. It's my feeling we shouldn't go any higher in this, and probably wouldn't hurt to set it lower, but that was an absolute maximum.
The other questions on line 9, same page, line 19, I mean line 9 and 11. 5/6 and the 1/6. Just my personal opinion, I think that'd be better to stick to 50 instead of 1/6 and 5/6. And the 100 million be raised to 500 million.
What page?
Page 6. The reason my thinking behind this is Alaska has always been capital poor. For any development projects which commercial banks have probably satisfied commercial customers and individual people through the individual loans have been mostly made through insurance companies or perhaps mortgage loans or housing and whatnot, and that market's probably taken care of. But for large investments such as hydropower, boat harbors, and well, renewable resources are right now the bottom fish industry, but I'm thinking of more than anything else. These are going to take huge capital investments over a long period of time at low interest rates. That is, if we want these. But under the system here, there isn't really enough money to take care of this because hydropower, I can think of $500 million worth of hydropower projects in the state right now.
I can think of one project.
Well, I'm not talking about Susitna at all. Exclusive of that, even. I think the federal government should build in boat harbors. It's really a state project that I think there's $200 million to be put into boat harbors and port developments in relation to recreation and the fishing industry combined. The bottom fishery is going to take, well, they tell us the price of these boats and shore installations, probably another $300 million. And I just feel that the $100 million is too low. Of course it can edge into I think the 50% I think would be more desirable, and of course this could be changed in the future.
Mr. Greening?
I think that's a good point, Leo, in terms of you can change it in the future. One thing you can't do, though, is if you get all the money out in long-term low-interest loans, you can't go back. One thing that we really struggled with was just what is a capital gap? Now, we've heard it explained many times. A capital gap can be a number of things, but we want to avoid a situation where we're merely replacing private capital, and there's a great danger to that when you're just say, throwing money out there. And isn't the interest rate often that is the determining factor in whether a loan is made? It's often the level of risk. And nobody could identify just what the capital gap was, but there was some kind of, there was a consensus that in rural Alaska, there is some need for small and medium scale investments for enterprise, for business enterprise and for municipal projects. So that while the figure of $100 million may seem low at this point, of course $100 million seems like a lot of money to me, including another $100 that they could borrow. Our approach was cautious one. Let's see what their track record is. Let's see what kind of investments they do get into. And after that, it's just a simple matter of lifting that limit for another 100 million or another 100 million. It can be done by a simple bill. So far, nobody, I know that we've got a sectoral analysis that's going to be presented one of these days, and until they identify just what instruments and what tools you're going to use to get into these various projects, it's obvious that if you say that the permanent fund is going to have to take care of all the capital needs of all the areas, hydro, renewable resources, that there just isn't enough money in 20 permanent funds to do it. But what we were trying to identify was that probably the medium and small scale projects that aren't getting financing now by anybody, but yet have some worthiness, credit worthiness. And so our approach was admittedly a conservative and cautious one. We felt that was what we heard the people telling us when we went around the state. You can always lift it. There's one way to approach it. If you feel that you need more money in the enterprise, you can always increase the contribution to the permanent fund and have that increased contribution go in the enterprise fund. But as for the 25%, we didn't think that was consistent to split that in half and say, well, half of it we're just going to put it out there just because we want to get it out there. The trust fund itself also can be invested in Alaska, and I think we've disposed of that point in terms of whether or not they're good investments, safe investments, whether that other 5-6 can be available in Alaska. There's no question that it can be. If it can't be, then I would say that the people that are investing our state pension funds are in real trouble.
Mr. Freeman. Oh, excuse me. Mr. Rudd, you want to follow that?
Well, my thought of this investments in long-term projects such as hydropower and boat marinas and boat harbors, which are badly needed. I can cite the Homer Boat Harbor, for instance, 800 stalls short. And these are revenue-producing, and so with hydropower. My philosophy behind this, or thinking, is if this money is tied up into these long-term projects, why future legislators and politicians are not going to squander it on some other things that would say that they've done some of it in the past. They won't have any money to play with. And on this 1/6, 5/6 ratio, I feel that most of this money is going to be sent to the states for investments outside when you really need them in Alaska, not in the states. If they're put in securities paying 5, 6, 7% interest, this is fine. And I don't think the government's philosophy is to go into business to make a profit. I think those funds should be left in Alaska as much as possible, at least, and invested in Alaska. This is my feeling for it, 50-50%.
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Green, I suppose everybody had their own ideas when they voted for the permanent fund in the beginning, but I suspect that when the people voted for the permanent fund, they didn't envision it being invested in any kind of risky investments. And I don't quarrel with the formula that we have. Conservative approach as far as the investment of funds concerned. I don't quarrel with the 561 approach, but it seems to me that some of the problems that Bill was talking about that the legislature can take care of outside of the fund. If we have the money, we can find the money, we can figure out a way to do that rather than to tamper with the formula of the permanent fund, and myself, I'd be very reluctant to change that, to increase the risk to the fund.
Mr. Swanson?
Yeah, I voiced the other day when we first discussed the permanent fund, and I don't see anything in this bill, again, that leads a permanent or a definite direction to renewable resources of, I think, of what John Q. Public voted for this permanent fund was to be plowed back into those renewable resources. No, this permanent fund that we're talking about, we're not talking about, we're talking about plowing our 25% of our non-renewable resources into a permanent fund, and those investments are to be used for renewable resources to take care of somebody down in the future, and that's exactly what we're talking about here. And it frightens me when vaguely we hear that human resources and capital improvement projects are to be called renewable resources. I think looking at the next 10 years of surplus monies over and above what we have right now, we're looking next year at an excess of $300 million surplus over this year's budget. Any capital improvement could come out of the general fund and not destroy the concept of our permanent fund, and I hope that we're headed in the right direction here. I hope we're headed in the direction of not turning this into human resources and just simple capital projects.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm not sure. Mr. Swanson, was that a statement in favor of Mr. Training's approach or against it?
Yes, it is, because in the approach of taking the money and using it for a capital project, if that's what I understand, I hope that that's not what his intention was when he wrote this bill. I hope that his intention was to plow this back into renewable resources. Maybe Mr. Greening can explain to me.
I still don't know what the answer to the question was. Mr. Greening,
maybe I can interpret. Brad has a bill in House Bill 4, which we plagiarized to some extent because it is a good basis. It involves very, very conservative investment scheme that produces income, and the income is used for renewable resources. And I don't think that approach is inconsistent with ours. And that was a bill that we took a look at, one of the first bills to be introduced on the permanent fund.
Yeah, I think that the conservative approach that your bill embodied is certainly in this proposed committee substitute.
Well, this was the again, Mr. Chairman, this was when we set a ceiling of $100 million worth of investments in Alaska and the balance could go outside. And I think that we can find there is available or those projects in Alaska that far we exceed $100 million worth of investments in Alaska. And I think that this ceiling here is awful tight toward Alaskan investments.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Brady.
Of course, you recall right under your bill, it all goes out. It's all invested in security. Again, I'd like to emphasize that there's nothing, that $100 million ceiling that keeps popping up here is only talking about the capitalization of the enterprise fund. So there's nothing in the bill that prohibits that the 5/6 or the 6/6 be invested in Alaska if it's prudent to do so. Probably any investment entity would not put all its eggs in one basket, even geographically, but there is nothing in the bill that limits in-state investments to $100 million. In fact, even the enterprise function itself has a $200 million capability, and the other 5/6 can be invested to a large extent in the state, just as the pension funds are presently. I refer to the Teachers Retirement Fund and the Public Employees Retirement Fund, which are both invested in the state.
Okay, are there further questions or comments on the proposed committee substitute? Mr. Rhodes?
On page 9, line 5, just merely a question. Why was $250 inserted there in a particular region?
What page was that, Leo?
Page 9, line 5. Compensation.
Okay. This is commensurate with some of the more the corporation directors in the valley, even bank boards. We wanted to make it that they're not getting paid full time to not to make it a financial hardship to meet discuss the management of the funds. So that's what it is. It's a equivalent to a director.
This is in lieu of the per diem?
No, wait a minute.
It's in addition to.
It's in addition, but it's in lieu of the salary.
Mr. Rhodes?
Yeah, page 10, line 22, section 1. Explain that a little more. 1 and 2, both. Particularly two, no okay. Portion of the assets of the corporation would be used to purchase the stock that would be used following the purchase.
That's a 30% limitation. In other words, stocks, the amount of your portfolio that can be placed in stocks is limited to that figure.
That's a pretty high figure, though, isn't it? Because you're really gambling when you're buying stocks.
Well, I tend to agree that it's a high figure, but I'm hoping that these trustees, who somebody pointed out, liable for the mistakes. They're not going to get in.
Trustees that much?
I'm open to suggestions.
I would just thought it should be lower than 30%. I'm just not into big points.
Well, we could follow the example of the pension funds. They're in 18%. I know that they've been getting out of the stock market.
Yeah, I just see the limits at 20%. If I can get any agreement.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Green.
Again, I was suggesting Mr. Rhodes we could insert my firing squad clause.
Yeah.
You come up with a bad debt, you take him out and shoot him at sunrise.
Mr. Swanson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my remarks were not in opposition to the bill, because I would relate it to a new pair of shoes, and we don't, of course, going to pinch until we try it on. And reading some of the reports of another bill that's on the other side, I far prefer the one that we have. And are we through the discussion on this bill?
Well, I was thinking, I was looking for my notes. Mr. Rhodes had some other comments. And it's my understanding that the speaker's going to have some comments.
You better hurry.
On the bill. Mr. Rhodes.
Page 20, line 10. The committee may not invest or guarantee obligations totaling more than 5% of the assets in the corporation. $5 million.
In a single program.
Yeah. Why would it 5%? It seems like it might be a little high. Both in the percent and also the 5 million. I don't know what basis it came up with the 5%.
It says at that point that you exceed that, then the legislature would have to approve the projects. It's a pretty good chunk of money, but if they're going to get into a single project of a size greater than that, then it requires the approval by the legislature. We argued that. We raised it one time. This is the enterprise fund.
Excuse me.
You mean it was higher than this at one time?
No, lower, and you suggested that we raise it.
Yeah, I would. My thinking would be lower.
Mr. Gardner, how do I handle this?
Mr. Speaker, or please, gentlemen. If people are interested in this vehicle financing Bottomfish, you're going to have it at $5 million. 150-foot trawler is about $4 million. Next year, probably be $5 million. So we had $1.5 million figure, and if people are seriously interested in doing bottom fish, $1.5 million isn't going to build you much anything. You're going to be down to about 100-foot boat. And certainly some of our trawlers are going to be of that class, and conversions maybe run $300,000-$500,000. But if you want some large vessels that are going to go out in the Bering Sea where 80% of the product is, in the Aleutian chain, compete where the foreign fleets are now, you're going to have some vessels of this magnitude, unless you want to have the legislature approve every one of them.
Mr. Rose.
Well, this was my concern about the 1656. I think it should be 50-50. Instead of 100 million, 500 million.
Well, you could put $1 billion in there, but if you don't allow the proper amount for each loan, it's not going to do any good.
Well, that'd be up to the trustees.
I'm not arguing with your point, Mayor. I'm just saying that if you want to loan to these kind of projects, I don't know whether you do or not, but if you do, you're going to have to allow them to have that high of maximum.
Unless you want the legislature to be in there to approve every loan, which I don't think.
No, I don't think you should approve it. But
that's
the only a political decision if they approve it, I'm sure.
Yeah. Make sure the animal is right. Commissioner Gallagher had a comment on that. Sir?
I'd like to ask Clark if he thinks the way this language is written is it's a modification of the Food and Manual.
Everything in the bill, every section in the bill, defines the duties and restrictions on the trustees. So it's the Food and Manual will be interpreted alike in this section as well as every other.
Well,
you're asking me to decide a hypothetical case.
I'm just suggesting that most diversification rules require something far more restrictive than the 5%.
It is a modification.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Haugen.
You know, the more I think about it, I suppose I'm going to really light a fire with what I'm saying. But I'm inclined to go along with the chairman of the committee on a conservative basis and establish some priorities for what that fund is going to be used in the public interest in the state. And I think it's pretty well established that hydroelectric power is probably one of the best public benefits that we can, on a long-term, low-interest financing base, and start out on this line. I am listening to all this concern about the needs in the fishing industry, and I know what they are, but I also know that there's a lot of groundwork that has to be done before we start sticking state dollars in there. We know the history of the agriculture business in the state. It's a tough proposition for any bank to finance. Now, same with the fishing industry. I think we've got to know what kind of resources we're dealing with, and I think I speak with some kind of knowledge of what's taking place. Right in my own hometown right now, they've got a contract for about 20 million pounds of pollock fillets, and they're having a heck of a time to get the resource, get the fish. They've got the fishermen there already. I don't want to be interpreted that I'm laying this real need aside, but I think if we go off on a conservative basis and take a look at what the real priorities in the state are, from the public, the taxpayer point of view, and recognize that, and then, as like Red said a minute ago, when you get your feet into a pair of new shoes, you can find out where you can work your way into these other areas. I don't want it construed that I'm knocking this concern for what the financial needs of the state are as far as the industry is concerned. But we do know what the local governments need in financing for utilities. I think if all they need is a hand to get on their feet, and they will, over the long haul, return a good average rate of interest to the permanent fund, maintaining the principal in whole.
Okay. The speaker's here, and cease to write the notes. Hugh, would you, you want to address the committee this time, Mr. Bill?
Thank you.
Mr. Speaker.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, testifying on House Bill 596, or the, it's basically on the enabling legislation the Alaska, for the Alaska Permanent Fund, I don't particularly want to go into the details of the language of the legislation itself. I think the committee's probably heard quite a bit about that. I think there's some basic points of view that I feel the committee should know about, and that I think are central questions in any enabling legislation that the legislature finally adopts on the Alaska Permanent Fund. Probably a lot of this you've heard before, but I think it's important enough in some cases that it bears repetition, not just here, but again and again and again. To begin with, without going deeply into the history of the thing, I think that the permanent fund was voted on and established by the people of the state of Alaska as a savings account approach to reserve some of the wealth or income that's coming into the state from the production of a high-value resource over a relatively short period of time for the future. And I think that that theme should appear in any final enabling legislation that this legislature passes, or failing that, that any legislature should adopt. I think that the basic 25% of the revenues accruing from the ownership interest in mineral development in the state was considered by the people of Alaska to be a bottom line savings account, and I think that any legislation adopted should reflect that. I think that anything less than that is inconsistent with the public purposes and the adoption of the constitutional amendment. The second thing is that one of the points that impressed me very early on in the consideration of the what should be done with the enabling legislation on the Alaska Permanent Fund springs from a discussion with some of the people from Alberta on how they're managing the Alberta Heritage Trust, some of the points that they consider important there. And one specific thing that I recall, and I think it's very important to keep in mind in the enabling legislation, is that a very large portion or percentage of the money in the fund, or the investments in the fund, should be in a highly liquid form of investment. And the reason for that is this, is that right now, we don't know what the future holds. It'd be very easy, of course, to commit the permanent fund and all the other revenues that the state has to purposes that we can identify right now. But if we do that, we're foreclosing the opportunity in the future, perhaps, to place those investments in returns which would be much more important to the state. And I think that the only way to preserve that option is to keep a significant portion of the fund in highly liquid form of investments. For instance, right now, in comparison with the general fund, we have a relatively high proportion of non-liquid investment in the general fund. We can, if we had to, I suppose, dispose of those investments at a discount to produce free money so that we could spend it. But I don't think that the Alaska Permanent Fund should face that sort of trade-off. I think that the, there should always be a high percentage of the money in highly liquid investments. Investments that can be sold quickly and at rates near the face or original value of the investment. And that means, I suppose, a good portion of the fund, I believe, needs to be biased towards what people would call blue chip investments. And the reason for that is to prevent too much of a bias itself, a bias occurring in the fund itself, and to prevent foreclosing the opportunity in the future of making investments that might be more important than any we see today. When the original concept was under discussion in the last legislature, there were a lot of times that I had reservations about the bill in 75, which was finally vetoed, and the constitutional amendment itself, because if we do create a public corporation in the state of Alaska with cash assets on the order of several billions of dollars, we might also be creating an economic and political monster in the state. So I think that the next most important point in the development of the enabling legislation, to me at least, is accountability. I don't think that the fund, being composed of public monies and serving a public purpose, should be beyond the control of the public. And I think the accountability is important if we don't want the corporation or whatever form this finally takes dictating political and economic policy to the people of the state of Alaska. I think you can point to minor instances right now where some other operations have run into those sort of difficulties, a difficulty of accountability to the public for a public operation. And after a great deal of consideration of the question over the last 3 years, I've come to the conclusion that to preserve the accountability to the public, that at a minimum the operating budget of the Alaska Permanent Fund should be subject to the same budget review and consideration process as the rest of our state government budget. That is, that the fund has to be accountable through the Executive Budget Act, or accountable through a system of review that provides for this, at least the same degree of public input through the elected representatives of the people of the state of Alaska, including the governor and the legislature. I guess that everyone that's talked about the fund, whether they're office holders or members of the public or people that have commented on the fund in a consulting capacity, and all of us have different ideas about what the Alaska Permanent Fund should accomplish, and naturally it's not going to accomplish all those ideas. We'd need 10 or 20 Alaska Permanent Funds to do that. But an argument that was made for the fund at the time of its adoption by the people is that it held a potential, at least, for economic diversification in the state. And I think that that's a rational goal. I think it's one that the fund could possibly accomplish if handled properly. And I think that in order to allow that opportunity to be there, you have to go back again to the question of liquidity of the fund. And also the question of, is a fund going to be involved in merely replacing existing sources of capital or capital funding, whether those capital funds come from the private sector or through the state or federal government budgets? And I would say generally that we ought to look for opportunities for investment of the fund that do not simply replace existing capital sources. I think that's where the greatest potential for the fund is in new opportunities. The you can make, I think, a somewhat rational political decision that we would rather have money that's owned by Alaskans, the Alaska Permanent Fund, in a given industry or a given capital area, over money that comes from the East Coast or money that comes from Japan or money that comes from some other place. But I'm not sure that that provides for economic diversification in the state. I think, on the contrary, I think what it does is provide for more of the same things that we have right now. In some cases, that's probably good, but it won't lead, I don't think, to economic diversification. I think that we need to look for the areas where, because of lack of information in the past, because of political or other institutional barriers, that capital is not available now, but areas that represent real economic potential. Those areas are probably fairly small in terms of the total capital required right now, but I think those are the areas that the fund should focus on if economic diversification is to be a goal of the fund. Personally, I think that it should be one of the goals of the fund. And the last thing I want to say is this, is that the effect of the investment of the Alaska Permanent Fund is something that's not going to occur today, of course. It's going to occur down the road, 3 years, 5 years, longer than that away, as amounts in the fund grow in significant proportions. And because of that, I think that it's unwise to bias the investment policy of the fund, either through the legislation itself, dealing with the corpus of the savings account or trust, whichever you want to describe it, or through the use of the revenues of the fund. I think what we might do by taking that sort of approach is to eliminate in the future potential for economic diversification and potentials that otherwise might never be developed. And so I would caution the committee and the legislature that any specific dedications or biases that might be necessary in the political process to adopt this legislation, or because existing needs seem to be so pressing, should be looked at very carefully and should be kept as small as realistically possible. As far as the use of the fund income, for instance, I think that it would be a major mistake to bias the investment policy of the fund and the opportunities to which it can be put in the future by an immediate dedication of the income from the Alaska Permanent Fund. And there's no doubt in my mind it will do that if we allocate now all the income from the fund, or even a very large percentage of it, for specific programs and purposes that are identified today. What will naturally happen is constituency groups will grow up around those purposes. It'll be very unlikely that those things will be changed. And I think that by doing that, we may have foreclosed an opportunity that could arise 5 years, 10 years, or 15 years into the future. And I realize that some of those things might be necessary. Some compromises might be necessary along those lines. There are substantial needs that exist in the state, very pressing ones that people in this committee are very familiar with. But I would urge the committee to keep those sorts of dedications or biases as what they are, as far as the investment policy of the fund goes in the future, to a minimum. Because I think that what we would do by building in those biases at the outset is, number one, through the creation of constituent group outside the fund in the public, make it politically very difficult to meet a higher purpose when that came along. And secondly, and maybe just as important, is you could create a constituent group within the fund itself that was directed toward those specific purposes and didn't have the vision, the breadth of vision, to look at what else was happening in the, or could happen in the economy of the state of Alaska. Those are my basic concerns on the Alaska Permanent Fund. I think consistent with the idea that this money was going to be a savings account, when the people voted on it, I think that was their main argument. And I think that up until at least this year, it has been the main argument for the Alaska Permanent Fund, is that within the context of keeping that fund accountable, and the necessary review by the elected officials of the state, people through their elected officials, that every step ought to be taken to keep the fund from falling prey to the bureaucracy that inevitably grows in government. And by that I mean to say that I don't think it should be located within any executive department. I think the history pretty well shows that in those cases, either one or two things happens. Bureaucracy would become a captive of the project, or more likely vice versa. And I don't think that's in the interest of the people of the state of Alaska either. If the importance and the need for immediate dedication of revenues exceeds what might be available from a 25% Alaska Permanent Fund, from the revenues that flow from a 25% Alaska Permanent Fund, immediate investments that might be available from other places, I'd suggest that the committee and the legislature consider increasing the dedication. I realize that's at the expense of the general fund revenues, but consider increasing the dedication above the 25% constitutional minimum to meet those purposes, so that in the end, the 25% that was approved by the people of the state of Alaska in 1976 remains intact. I think that pretty well sums up the major concerns that I have with the fund, except that beyond the actual investment policy and the things that happen as a result of the fund's investment policy, I think the Alaska Permanent Fund exists in a context of what the philosophy of the state and the people in it is. And I think to a larger, at least important extent, what happens with the Alaska Permanent Fund will be not only a reflection of existing philosophy in terms of what the people of Alaska want to see happen, but to some extent will condition or dictate the philosophy of the future. I think it's very important in its symbolism. And I think that that's something that has to be kept in mind when dealing with the subject. It's a personal observation, of course. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If there's specific questions on the points I raised or the philosophies behind them or the legislation itself, glad to try to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Speaker, your suggestion that if some of the needs and approaches that we wanted to take would require more than 25%, couldn't we do that outside? Couldn't we, the legislature, couldn't we do that outside of the permanent fund and as the programs or the need or inclination arose, rather than
tampering with the formula, the figure that the public approved of. I incidentally, I agree with you that I think the public, when they voted for it, thought of it as a savings account, and therefore, as far as I'm concerned, one that was good as gold. No question, no shaky investments, no wild-eyed schemes involved in. But if there is a need, if the money is available over and above the 25%, and there is a need, couldn't we do that outside of the legislation that we have before us?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Freeman, I think that would be the preferred way to do it. I think it's important to keep in mind that the 25% is 25% of the state's ownership interest, that in addition to that, on when it comes to the non-renewable resources, nominally at least, we have an equivalent amount that the state realizes through its tax policy. And then beyond that, we have additional taxes that come from things, some of which are affected, some of which are not affected by non-renewable resource development. So we're probably talking about at the most 1/8 and probably something like a 10th or a 12th of the total state revenues going into this fund. And even though it's very large, the amount that is not subject to the reservation of the constitutional amendment is far larger. And I think that it's the preferred course of action is to meet these other needs from the state budget. But it's become fairly apparent as the fund, the different discussions on the fund have evolved in the State Investment Advisory Committee in 1976 and the committee process during 77, the public process that went along with it, that there are areas of major concern in the state and fairly well-organized constituent groups that would like a direct tap on guaranteed funding for their programs. And some of those are, the purposes at least, are quite legitimate. The things that have to be looked at, the things where money has to be invested without question. And what I'm saying is that if the trade-offs, if there are trade-offs necessary, and those trade-offs involve providing guaranteed funding for a certain sector of the Alaska economy for a certain set of programs, guaranteed through either the investment of the fund or the use of its earnings, that in order to protect the integrity of the basic 25% and still meet the needs of these trade-offs, if they're required, if that's required, then I'd suggest the committee and the legislature consider expanding, increasing the level of contribution to the fund. I'd personally much rather place these other needs, to the extent that they are things that can be funded from the public budget, in competition with every other need that exists in the state, so that each year a decision could be made on the desirability of the level of investment or appropriation.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Are there further questions, Speaker Malone, on this issue? If not, Mr. Speaker.
One final specific point. In different areas of investment, we can talk about the bottom fishery, or we can talk about hydroelectric development, agricultural development, tourism potential, a lot of things. The state right now does not have all the information to know what the capital needs are, much less all the information is to know what the possible sources of funding for these particular needs might be. And I think that under those circumstances, the legislature would be very wise to proceed cautiously and not take a position of either undercommitting or overcommitting permanent fund, the revenues that flow from it, or the general fund until the level and desirability of investment in these and other areas become apparent. And that's not something that's going to happen today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. probably one of the best comprehensive statements of velocity behind this permanent fund bill that I've ever heard. I appreciate your presenting to us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to talk to the committee. I regret that I haven't done so before, but I appreciate that.
Mr. Haugen.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent we report on committee substitute for House Bill 596.
All right, Mr. Haugen moves and asks unanimous consent that we report out finance committee substitute for House Bill 596 with the amendments approved by the committee. Is there objection to the motion? If there's no objection, the motion carries. The bill will be reported out. How many good passes do we have? Majority do pass.
Mr. Chairman, I suggest when you get the thing worked up, everybody has a chance to take a look at it.
Okay.
Done by the paper.
Just starting.
Okay.
It's just starting.
Okay, we'll hold the bill then until it's typed up, so we can take one final look at the draft. We will be taking up the health and social service budgets this afternoon whenever we are able to escape from the floor. Meeting is adjourned.
Mr. Chairman, we're going to have to start with social services because health's still being coming out of the computer.
All right.
Just a second.
Can we start with social services?
Yeah.
Part can be taken to a show.
Instead of health. Yep. Like the word.
Is there an entertainment contract?
There's a, I've got a request for a bill that I've got a lot of backup for a supplemental that ARCA's asking for. And I want to get that started. Consider, I wonder if you could move to have the bill introduced. Anyone have an objection to the supplemental for $84,000 for ARCA? And there's a ton of backup here. I can't tell you why they need it at this point, but it's.
You want
they
to do
say
it in
they
the
need
bill
it.
Rather than in the budget?
Well, no, it's a supplemental.
It's a supplemental.
They need it. I forgot they need it by a certain day, and they said they'd come down and testify on it.
Well, putting it in doesn't mean you have to vote for it.
Would you object to holding the request till Steve gets here?
No.
We can, with the understanding.
Okay.
Yeah. A little more comfortable with him.
Okay. First, page 3. No budget. Page 5.
I guess he's still surviving.
Governor's figures. Page 7. Governor's from the last plan.
What's the last plan?
It's that. Listen, we've had it for several years. It's it's for employment, Alaskan employment. Wait a minute.
Did you have a budget breakdown in there? On the Alaska plan?
I did. We have what's in the red. Well, no, we don't even have anything in the red book this year. I mean, I haven't received anything in common. This is what they're going to spend it.
They're in transition.
No. And that related to when we we're going to get into the pipeline.
Well, it's any public contract either has to come under this. Any public construction contract has to come under the Alaska plan to have a certain goal for minority hire.
Okay. If there's no questions, then longevity bonus, page 9. We took the governor's figures. Then it starts with Pioneer's home. The first one would be on page 13.
What did you do with page 9?
Governor's figures. Sitka.
Longevity's governor.
Yes.
Is it the Pioneer Home, Governor Steve's? Fairbanks Pioneer Home was also the governor's figures.
Russ, I'm having a problem. On the Alaska plan, could you request a program objective for this $180,000? I know that this body is generous, but I'd like to know what they're doing this time, so I would like to request a program objective.
Okay.
I want a copy of it.
Okay.
Where are we now?
We're on page 15 now. This is Fairbanks Pioneer Home.
15 of Social Services.
That would be the governor's figures. Governor's budget. Page 17 is the Palmer Pioneer Home. That's also the governor's figure. Page 19, Kotzebue. Pioneer Home in Kotzebue, governor's figures on that.
What do you mean, that thing?
What? Russ,
yeah.
When are they going to finish with the Pioneer Home? We just laid on a supplemental.
Yeah, I can't. What date did they say?
Well, they were beginning construction March 1st to finish it, and I guess maybe take a couple months. Hopefully.
I thought they said they'd have it by, 3 months or something like that to be finished.
Is this a contract from the LALAC to run it?
Right.
What is the possibility, Milt? That's an ASHA bond issue, right? Do we have to pay off the whole bond issue in order to transfer the building to the city?
That's what I understand from the legal people.
How much of a bond issue is it?
Well, there are a couple bond issues.
Is that on each one of them?
I forget how much, but I think there was the original bond issue was around $9 million or something like that. I can check it out.
Because it seems to me we're better off just paying off the bond issue and give the city of Kotzebue the facility and let them do whatever they want to. We got to pay them. We're paying it off anyway.
Can we? I have a question.
Yeah.
Legally, can we single out one portion of the bond issue? That amount of money and pay that off, we have to pay off the whole bond issue?
The whole bond issue, because the bonds were not singled out for a single facility.
I understand.
They bought ASHA bonds for all of their systems. Yeah. Milt, can we get a report on that? Where that bond issue is and how much it would cost to pay it off? Because I think that's what we ought to do with this thing.
It's like a submarine, it just sinks below the surface.
That's what it did.
Yeah, okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Meek?
Okay, unless there are other questions on that. The next Pioneer Home would be the Anchorage one. And Anchorage, of course, is the one we heard testimony on in regards to the contracting out to Nana Manning, and I know the committee is familiar with that. They were authorized 87 full-time last year, and they end up with 51. Would be their maintenance because of the contractual nature of some of their employees. The governor allowed them 49, cut them two essentially, and we took the governor's figures on that. But one thing we did run into in looking at it is that there was a plan to have the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, which I've looked at their laundry facilities. They're in a quite large, they have excess capacity, and so they've been doing laundry of McLaughlin, and they were going to do the Anchorage Pioneer Home, and they were doing for a relatively pretty good price. I think it was 25 cents a pound, wasn't it, Bill? And that's in the ballpark with the commercial people. So, but because the Pioneer Home went out to bid, they got evidently a cheaper price, like maybe 20 cents a pound or something from Snow White Laundry. But as far as Pioneer Home's concerned, it saves them money, but as far as the state's concerned, it doesn't, because
we pay the same for the people doing the laundry over there, whether they do APIs and Pioneer Homes or not. So we're gonna have to pay double, in fact, in essence, if the laundry's done at Snow White. So what we did was we put in intent that the laundry for Pioneer Homes should be done at API. And it seems like a small item, but you're talking about a lot of, we haven't tracked out exactly the money, but Milt estimates $100,000 to $200,000, so we just sort of quickly did it. I don't know that that's the accurate figure. Maybe it isn't, but it's a lot of money in any case, so.
Snow White may as well get you.
Yeah, he's my best friend.
No taking the laundry.
How many people have
proposed, not signed?
How many people work at API and in relation to how many work at Pioneer Homes? Because they do all their own, personal laundry.
Where?
Maybe losing at these institutions, hospitals, whatnot. All the people work there do their own laundry there.
Well, at API, they have a large laundry facility, and they have.
How many people work there?
In the laundry?
No, in the whole institute.
So will I have to?
Well, I mean. I mean, they're gonna do their laundry at the state's expense.
Their own personal laundry?
No.
No, this is for the people that are in the hospital.
Yeah, but they'll do their own personal laundry.
13.
They always do it on the institute.
If they are, they're doing it one way or the other. I mean, that might be true, but the point is that regardless of, I mean, they were gonna do the Pioneer Homes laundry too, but now they're. Okay, so that's the only change in Anchorage. And the Pioneer Homes Central Office, we took the governor's figures. Next one would be child support enforcement, page 25.
So far.
Governor's salary taken, right?
I moved the figure to zero.
Mr. Chairman?
Every year.
Are these the daddy changers?
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is the child support enforcement, the daddy chasers again. They've been moved around from place to place. Nobody seems to want them. One change in what's happening this year from last year is that they are at least paying their way. One of the problems I had with them last year is we were spending more money on them than they were collecting. So.
No, we lose anyway.
This year, at least, that's not the case, but they do have a backlog. Just depends on whether or not you believe in the program. If you believe in the program, they do desperately need these 8 people. You know, I mean, it depends on whether or not. In testimony, it came out pretty clearly that there are some people that are really, really need to be helped by the state, because there are some families that deserve these payments. But on the other hand, because of the way it gets set up, there are some people that get screwed over by it too. So it just sort of depends on which side of that you're on, I think.
I'm not sure if I understand, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Swanson?
What do you mean that it pays for itself?
Well, I don't really mean that.
Okay.
What I meant was that last year.
$121,000.
Last year, you see, what we're trying to do is collect money from the fathers and give it to the mothers, basically.
Did we get $1 million worth of?
And last year, it was costing us in administration, it was costing us about twice as much as they were collecting. So it just seemed like we should have just fired everybody and give the money directly to the mothers, you know, it'd be more efficiency. But this year, at least, they're collecting.
They cut the personnel down by about 47 people by just giving it.
Let's see, I think, I don't know.
What's the program receipts? That is the collection. You got a program receipt of 4536, is that, what's that?
That's their share of collection.
You got paying their way.
Zero this program out, these guys would become the chasees, the chasers.
Okay, any? The committee's recommendation is the governor's budget.
Okay.
Oh, what a bunch of crap.
Vern, you got a question?
Prices increase triple in 2 fiscal years.
What to me, I don't care, to hell with it, don't pay attention to me, I get so tired of this here.
Ernie, in 77, I think we just gave them a $600,000, isn't that what we did?
back in '76, I can't remember, but I think we just gave them $600,000 or something like that and told them to operate within that budget.
One of the other things to remember is that the increase from 23 full-time to 40 full-time was partly offset by decreases in other budgets, such as the health budget, where they took the people out of health and put them into this area, so the total budget, in a sense, didn't increase as much because there was compensating reductions other places.
Okay, but do I read it correctly that we spend $1,769,000 to collect $450,000?
They're collecting more than that. The state only gives a certain percentage, I believe it's 25% of the collection.
They get a rake off out there, they're taking it away.
Well, then, that $450,000 still, that represents 25%, then, huh? They still aren't paying.
Sorry, federal money is free.
We have the exact figures, Clark, that they gave us if you want. And as I remember, they were different than this.
$3 to $4 million.
They were collecting substantially more than the cost of the program.
Well, it was only $238,000.
The point to remember is that the federal law mandates the state to make the payments to the mothers on AFDC, regardless of whether they can get the fathers to reimburse the state. So what you're talking about is that the $453,000, I think, probably represents money that the state has given out to certain families, and then has found the father and has been reimbursed. And that's what the program received, at least partially, what the program received would be composed of.
Why is it broken out? You've got the general fund, the general fund match this time, last time was...
There's 75% federal match for certain portions of the cost related to welfare recipients.
Mr. Kelly, I guess the question I would have, why the clerk typist here? It seems to me that the area that you want to be increasing would be the ones who are actually doing the...
Chasing.
Instead of the ones...
Daddy chasing three, right?
Sitting, well, you know, I mean, if that's what the program's all about, they'd be the ones that are now looking for the daddies instead of sitting in office.
One of the, this program, if you give these people a call, you have a lot of trouble, because constituents will call me, and they won't even do it on the phone anymore. You gotta do it, you know, you gotta go through a whole rigmarole, because they've still got such a big backlog. There's also a bureaucratic baloney to go through. One of the other things that I think may be an improvement is that last year we required they go to an adjudicated procedure where you don't have to go through the courts and get it, I mean, administrative procedure, you don't have to get it adjudicated, and whatever the right words are. And so they're just about to implement that, and they figure 75% of the cases will be able to be resolved by administrative hearing as opposed to going to court. And that's gonna save a lot of time, especially for people involved, and it's gonna have some efficiencies, because a lot of their time's wound up in waiting for the court case and that kind of stuff. So that's an improvement.
But...
Do you have any women or mommy chasers? Is it all...
I know there's some around town.
Being legislators, that was...
I didn't mean that.
No, I don't know.
This is discrimination.
Mr. Chairman, if the court would say that the mother is responsible for payments, then they would go after her.
And incidentally, they do with some regularity claim that...
Well, that's what I was asking.
Yeah, it would apply.
One of the inequities of this program is that if the situation existed, for instance, the court judged that the father make payments of $100 per child per month, then his wife, say, left the state, and he doesn't even have the ability, because he doesn't have a lot of money, to see his kids, he's still gotta make the payments, and if she happens to marry somebody who's wealthy, it doesn't make any difference. They don't take into consideration her new resources. He still has to make that $100 a month, unless he adopts kids.
Is that a federal law?
The judgments are made based on his ability to pay, not her new situation. So
no, well, what it is, they it's just a recognition that the new husband of the old wife, whatever it is, doesn't have any responsibility for the children.
Right.
So,
does this apply strictly to legalized marriages and separations or divorces, or how about How about for those babies that are born out of illicit activities?
My understanding is where paternity is proven or acknowledged, then it would be. But we had a big fuss over this business a couple of years ago where they tried to give the agency the authority to drag in the mothers and force them to testify to everybody they slept with and that kind of stuff. And that is highly offensive to me. And I, but except for that, you know, if the mother voluntarily, you know, I guess you'd have to institute a paternity proceeding or something like that. But if it's established, if the father, who the father is, it would apply.
I have a question. We went from 122,006 to 537,000 since the conception of the job in contractual. What kind of contractual services would you get there for $500,000? Is that a building payment, rent, building or something?
See, they have $150,000 for two lawyers on contract, two lawyers and two secretaries in the Department of Law. And then they have a several other Loomis Armored Car Service, University of Alaska, blood test, expert testimony,
cash sales.
What's the Armored Car Service for?
Take a raging man and call their corporation around.
I'm not sure.
Call their corporation around. Go back up the door out here after we adjourn.
Is there anything, are there further comments or objections, motions, or whatever on this?
How many families were helped under this program?
Well, they said that they had about 14,000 cases now. They had anticipated about 9,000. Last year, but that it turned out to be about 14,000.
Mr. Chairman,
in the state of Alaska,
is that 14,000 children or
14,000 cases? I understand.
Nobody pays it.
Mr. Chairman, the pipeline was a tremendous impact. We have what we call a URISA agreement, you know, and all the daddies that came up here from Louisiana. We have to track them down in Dietrich or whatever, you know, when there's a pipeline and try to get them to pay back to Louisiana because they've agreed to do that for ours that leave. But we had a lot more absent fathers up here than they had of ours down there. So we did get the bad end of that agreement. But it was also a requirement with the federal funds. I would like to respond to Mr. Swanson's question on contractual, other than the ones mentioned. The real reason for most of the increase there is due to communications increase, and I think it's a good idea. What they decided to do is to send out monthly bills, because they evidently, people in this field find that if a guy sent a letter every month that says, you know, $100 is due or whatever, they're much more likely to pay than if they don't ever get any bills. And so this is what they're doing in terms of trying to improve their collections. And it does cost, it is increasing that budget $161,000. But they think that it'll be very much more efficient. That's one of the reasons for the increases in contractual rate.
Based on the pipeline, now that the pipeline is over and we'll start another one in a couple of years, what will we expect a reduction in this force in the next budget?
Well, you know, they're still claiming they need the 68 that we didn't give them last year to do their job. So we didn't give them that, and they haven't even really gotten their whole backlog taken care of yet. And I asked them that, and they said, no, you know, of course not. They wouldn't. It'd still be just need all these people.
whatever you think.
The oral firing squad.
Okay, okay, there's no questions on that.
Governor's here.
Right. Okay, the next, next budget is page 29, and it's vocational rehabilitation. Generally, these budgets are, the agency was happy with them, and the governor was happy with them, and they're basically a lot of maintenance budgets, so I think in almost all cases in Oak Rehab, except for maybe one area, we gave them a governor's figure. So on page 29, counseling and placement, that is the governor's figures.
Russ, I got a question on that. What is the other cost of those rehab counselors that throws it up for about double the salary? What's the, what is that?
What are you referring to?
Well, the salary, you got one guy there, the per number, position one, Voc Rehab Counselor 2, salary and benefit 32.5, other costs 36.5. What's that represent?
Our.
This is a car office.
Yes.
This is a car office.
Yeah, car office desk.
Have you cut any positions yet?
66 grand in so-called other costs, and I just wondered what.
Travel, contractual, and commodities. The contractual is most of the 28,500. Contractual is phones, postage, toll, etc.
No car?
Are these people already on board?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, this is the, this is a new, there's a, we're taking over an evaluation unit there's evaluation of handicapped people is currently done in Seattle, Tacoma. And these positions that we've authorized here, if you see, we actually save a few dollars. It's not much different. We have a contract right now for, I think, $117,000 or something like that, or might be $170,000. I'll have to check. For Seattle, Tacoma, we send people out there and they get judged on their handicap and evaluated on what kind of jobs they can do. Because one of the things about placing people in a job, you have to guarantee to the employer that they'll be able to perform that job for some period of time. So you need some pretty stringent evaluations of them. And this evaluation unit is currently not in the state. We have to send everybody to Seattle, Tacoma evaluation unit. So what we're doing in this budget is we're taking over that. There's some money in contractual for rent, some money in equipment, and these new counselors. So that's why these counselors have these added costs. But the total amount is just a little bit less. We're saving a little bit more, than we would if we kept doing outside. And the benefit of doing it in state, of course, is, I think, worth it, even if it costs more. But it does save us a little bit of money in the long run. Yeah, and these are mostly one-time costs, and so after we get them this year, we'll have a savings, I think, perhaps. So that was the governor's budget. Services defiance is the governor's figures. You notice that from the maintenance figure of 1944, there's a substantial reduction. That is due in part to $144,700 decrease due to this evaluation unit change. So that this was one of the things that was paid out of this budget. So we saved $144,000 there. Compensate for those other increases.
They're figuring on a 10% inflation right now.
Mr. Chairman, some of these budgets are figuring 25% inflation rate. Not voc rehab, but now the medical ones are figuring 25%.
They shouldn't do that. They should never stay over the 6%, Mr. Chairman. It's just gravy somewhere.
Not medical, the medical expenses, they can show you they're going up 40%.
You get a doctor to get in that.
Okay.
That's right, the doctor's ripping off.
Yeah, right. And as long as we get it done.
Okay, page 33, administration, governor's figures. Page 35, specialized facilities, governor's figures.
What, governor?
Yes. What was this 80, huh? Oh, yeah. On page 37, then, the next budget would be state-supported facilities. We have 80,000 in there. This is a request from Representative Gardner for $80,000 for the Gateway Opportunity Center.
Where is that specialized facility?
Specialized, no, did I skip that? Specialized facilities is the governor's budget.
Okay.
Page 37, excuse me.
What was 35, governor's figures?
Yes.
State-supported
facilities, page 37. We have $80,000. The $80,000 goes to the Gateway Opportunity Center.
Where does it go under? On page 37?
It goes under line 700, line grants and claims. We have legislative intent. $80,000 is to be paid as a grant to the Gateway Opportunity Center in Ketchikan.
What is it?
It's more or less a sheltered workshop for handicapped individuals. Some training, job training for handicapped people, basically.
Mr. Freeman may be able to explain it better, but
essentially right. If it be a help to you, they on their budget, 30% goes for wages and 30% for staff wages and 5% fringe benefits and 6% occupancy, utilities, workman's comp, so forth. 16% for materials. And on their income, if you want to know where their income comes from, they get 44% of it from Louisiana Pacific, 19% from the Department of Environmental and Disabilities, 14% from the city, and 8% from group home rent, 10% from retail sales, 3% from the Forest Service, and 2% from the Division of Voc Rehab.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the estimate is that this year the difference between their outgo and their income is going to be about $80,000, and this will make up the difference, allow them to keep the program.
The figure is
$80,000? Yes, it is.
Did the ARCA people talk to you? Did you get to talk to Bob Choi?
No.
We have a request
there. I'll have to get the material. Well, this check, yeah, I'm sure they got it. It may be in this budget, but I'm not sure about it.
ARCA is under official DRU, I believe.
No, they've never had a, they'd like to have a BRU, but right now I think they appear under one of these.
Yes, sir.
Vocation, employment of the handicapped, don't they? No. Which one do they appear under?
The one we're looking at, state supported facilities, last year had $600,000 for ARCA and $100,000 for the Fairbanks Rehabilitation Association. And those amounts are still in the budget, but they were transferred to developmental disabilities and mental health.
So it's in a different category, isn't it?
The director of developmental disabilities tells me that he thinks that they will perhaps leave the ARCA grant in developmental disabilities because they do have quite a few of those types of patients, but the Fairbanks people are dealing mostly with handicapped individuals, and they may want to move that grant back to this component in vocational rehabilitation, which deals with handicapped individuals.
That's next year, though.
Well, next year. They have to do a survey to see what kind of individuals they have there.
Does it
how does it appear in the health budget? Is it broken out, or is it just part of it?
It's a grant, there's no, we don't have any legislative intent that it's a particular amount goes to ARCA as opposed to FRA.
Okay, so there's a $600-$700 item in the health side. Okay. Maybe we can kind of keep this in mind when we get into it, because I know that I think they're asking for an additional $100,000. I've got the backup.
Next budget would be disability determination under, still under voc rehab, page 39. Again, we have the governor's figures. So. I might say it appears from this printout that they got the governor's figures are a reduction of two people. You know, it doesn't show up on the report because of the RFP. I don't know if that's right.
Either
one. So there was an RP in 78 that gave him two more people, but the governor still kept him at eight, so I don't know what the computer did here that isn't listed on this sheet.
Yeah, two people.
The 78 RP.
Okay.
So check that out. Okay, page 41, employment of the handicapped. The total figure is 55,200. That's the governor's figure. Youth Employment Services, we increased the governor's budget to $120,000. This BRU's bounced around in 77, it was $180,000. Last year our subcommittee recommended it be zero. The Free Commerce Committee then put in $60,000 back into it, only for Anchorage. Their request was to go back up to $178,000. To gear up for the whole state, I guess the governor limited to $70,000, and it's my understanding that both the House and the Senate are going to come in with this $120,000. Although I know we can't talk about the Senate, but and the $120,000 is $60,000 grant to Anchorage, and another $60,000 if Anchorage matches it with 30. So you're talking about $120,000 to Anchorage area this budget for Youth Employment Services. Now, I might say I was really skeptical of this YES budget, and that's why we cut it to zero last year, because we heard some real bad complaints about it, that they really weren't doing anything. The goal of it is really good, to help young people get employed. Since that time, I've spent a lot of time this summer talking to people, going around to businessmen, especially in the Anchorage area, and they really do utilize that service in the Anchorage area. There's a lot of people that the restaurants in town and a lot of people claimed that it was a very useful service, and National Alliance of Businessmen were behind it. So looking into it, at least it seemed like in the Anchorage area it was working well. And because of our high unemployment, it seemed to me like maybe we ought to put some money back into this effort. So.
What's the rest of the state going to do? Are they not going to get back into it?
Well, we haven't had any proposals, you know, so I don't know. We've heard some bad things about the rest of the state. I hate to just give them money without knowing whether or not it's a good proposal. If you've got one, Jim, I mean, I think it's a good program if it's working, but the problem is that in some areas the state hasn't worked too well, and they haven't done anything. In the Anchorage area, I'm convinced, and I wasn't last year, but I am convinced this year that they're accomplishing something, so that's why I put it back in.
So how much is it?
It's $120,000. On page 45 is a summary page for AFDC, Old Age Assistance, Aid to the Blind, Aid to the Disabled, and General Relief. Now, these budgets, you know, they're just going crazy. These budgets are key to the economy to a certain extent, and there's more people claiming. They're claiming larger amounts. Certain areas, general relief we've already talked about. All of these figures will probably be changed by the end of this session. But rather than try to plug in the money right now, and they keep changing every week, they keep changing their estimates, and we don't really know whether they're going to really need it or not, I just took the governor's figures, which were prepared many, many months ago, 6 months ago, and they're old figures, and they're going to come in free conference, Clark, and want to change almost every one of these, but I thought it was better to budget them at the governor's figures and then have them make a case for why they got to be increased. But for instance, in general relief, I'm budgeting 500,000, and with the supplemental that's already passed the House and is pending in the Senate, their budget's gonna be 700-something thousand. So we, you know, so it, that's not a real figure in that sense, but I thought it's best to take the governor's figures and let him make a case for what they have to do later.
What's the fiscal note on the bill the Senate just sent over to us on this? What does it do to this figure?
On which budget?
The AFDC. It's got the number of this bill. There was 11 sponsors.
A lot of money, yeah.
12 sponsors.
About